Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I am Ursula Rudenberg, your host for today. Thank you for listening in. Today it's partly sunny and windy with a high near 44 and wind gusts as high as 33 miles per hour. Tonight should be mostly cloudy and then gradually become mostly clear with a low around 26. The rest of the week should vacillate between sunny and cloudy skies, with sun on Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday. Temperatures will go anywhere from the 30s up until the 50s and could even reach low 60s next weekend. However, night will drop down to the low 30s, so winter is coming. No precipitation is expected during the week, but could return by the weekend. And here is a summary of some of the area headlines from last week from the iowainformer.com. Last Monday, the Iowa Supreme Court sided with lawyers representing Planned Parenthood of the Heartland and the American Civil Liberties Union of Iowa to temporarily block part of a state law passed earlier this year that required women to wait at least 3 days before they could get an abortion. The block will remain effective until an appeal of Polk County District Judge Jeffrey Farrell's ruling that the law is constitutional is resolved. Farrell ruled that although the law is, quote, arguably the strictest mandatory waiting period law in the country, unquote, it doesn't pose an undue burden for women seeking abortions. Iowa Insurance Commissioner Doug Omen and Governor Kim Reynolds announced that they were dropping a proposal with the Federal Department of Health and Human Services to implement a, quote, stopgap insurance plan in Iowa intended to stabilize its failing Affordable Care Act marketplace. The proposal would have replaced subsidies with tax credits in an effort to make the marketplace more competitive. Earlier this month, the Washington Post reported that President Trump personally intervened to have the proposal rejected. The proposal's rejection means that many Iowans could face higher individual health insurance premiums. In a high-stakes vote, thousands of Iowa union members chose to recertify their affiliations with their unions on Tuesday. According to the Iowa Public Employment Relations Board, 436 out of 468 of the state's public union bargaining units were recertified. The vote was required because of a state law passed in February that weakened collective bargaining rights. Now they must hold recertification votes whenever they have new contract negotiations, which typically happens once every 2 or 3 years. To remain certified, a majority of the employees covered under a collective bargaining contract must also approve it now. And finally, a recent audit released by the Office of Republican State Auditor Mary Moseman criticized Iowa State University and its former president, Stephen Leith, for failing to obtain approval from the executive director of the Iowa Board of Regents in the purchase of a 498,000 Cirrus SR-22 airplane. The audit also found that 52 of the 76 trips taken in the plane after its purchase by the university in 2014 were for Leith's pilot training and lacked a, quote, clear business purpose as required by state law. He said, based on the limited use of the airplane for flights with clear business purposes, we question whether the purchase served a university purpose. University officials have countered that Leith acted appropriately and had fully reimbursed ISU for trips that mixed business and personal activities. The plane was sold in June 2016 for $450,000. And that is some of the headline news from last week from the iowainformer.com. And congratulations, Cyclones, on your homecoming win. In it to win it.
The night is dark, the wind is chill.
Creepy things are happening, I can tell.
Wonderful things on their boots.
Mummies are stumbling from their tombs.
Spiders are crawling, they're everywhere.
Hey, I've got spider webs in my hair.
Ghosts are rising from their graves. Bats are flying from their caves.
Being cast.
Monsters and zombies.
There's an eerie fog on the lake.
Crones are cackling, potions are being brewed.
The Frankensteins are having a family feud.
The creatures rising from the black lagoon.
Flying saucers are coming from the moon.
People are being replaced by pods.
Steve Rogers Smith. We are located right across the street from Ames Community Preschool, and my husband and I love to do Halloween for the smaller kids. We decorate so kids will have a lot of fun. I have the inflatables set, so about the middle of the afternoon they will inflate, so the kids, when they're outside playing, can look across, and when they're going home, they and their parents sometimes will stop. It's a little scary, but it's not super spooky. We have a ball doing this. Halloween has always been one of our favorite holidays, so we decorate outside. We've been doing this for about 9 years. Every place we've lived, we wind up being called the Halloween house. On trick-or-treat nights, my husband and I are outside and we're in costume, and we have fog machines, three of them going, so we get a nice fog hovering all over the ground, which is really cool. We just really have a lot of fun with it.
Well, my name is Diane Corson. We have a few inflatables that we put up. We have a cat with a head that moves back and forth, and that seems to drive every dog in the neighborhood crazy. I really don't know why we do this, but I have to admit that Halloween is my favorite season. Decorating for Halloween is something I enjoy doing. We've lived in the same neighborhood here for about 30 years. One of our neighbors started putting decorations in their yard, and people up and down the block picked up on it. It's a fun thing to do, so we still carve pumpkins, and we still put these things out every year. And the neighborhood has a lot of young children in it now, and so we really enjoy seeing them come around and enjoy this, and I guess that's why we keep putting them up.
Strange clouds cover up the moon.
The night is dark, the wind is chill.
Creepy things are happening, I can tell.
Witches are praying on their boots.
Mummies are stumbling from their tombs.
Spiders are crawling, they're everywhere.
Hey, I've got spider webs in my hair.
Ghosts are rising from their graves.
And you are listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm Ursula Rudenberg, your host for today. The music you just were listening to was Spider Webs in My Hair by Ames composer Clark Ford. Thank you, Clark. 2 weeks ago, the folks who run the Haunted Forest here in Ames were on Local Talk and were describing the elaborate operation that goes on down there, and really made me aware of how much creativity and dedication goes into haunted houses. Anna Samch is a volunteer at KHOI, and she prepares the morning section of Classical Sunday for KHOI. But she's also a haunted house person. She's worked in Halloween haunted houses most of her life. So I was really curious about haunted house culture, and I asked her to record an interview with me explaining why she has worked in haunted houses. And this is what she told me.
I've been working in haunted houses since I was 5 years old, actually.
Since you were 5 years old.
Yes, wow. When the first time I did a haunted house, they put me in a Chucky costume.
Chucky costume.
Yes.
Okay.
Back then, that was the big scare for
And what
the,
did you do in the Chucky costume?
I just walked around the hallways. I knew how to do that little skitter-scatter noise, you know, that always creeps out parents when they hear their kids in the hallway. And they just hear that little skitter to one end of the corner and then to another. And they go, they're up to something. So they put me in a Chucky costume, and I would just skitter around the maze area.
And did you enjoy doing it?
Oh, I loved it.
What do you remember about it?
Mostly the screams.
You liked hearing people scream?
Oh, I love the reactions. I love seeing them jump 3 feet in the air. Sometimes people running, trying to run the other way back out, but they can't figure out where they went because they took like 3 left turns and 2 rights.
And you were 5 years old at the time.
Oh, yeah.
Is there any way that you can explain why it was so much fun?
Because it was seeing a reaction, because I'm used to people being so, do not react, and then nothing will happen.
So you like the action.
Yes, try to bring a bunch of drama to people, but that's why I think I moved to haunted houses instead, because I found fear to be a much more entertaining reaction than seeing all this drama today. People always lying about somebody else doing this, and then...
Uh-huh. So tension and conflicts between people.
Yeah.
You didn't like that.
Yeah, the difference between it with horror is... The fact that you scare them and they have all these other feelings. I mean, like, people are overwhelmed with being happy that they're still walking around alive, or that they love the person that they're with, or they absolutely hate the person that they're with because they just shoved them in front of a ghoul. It means that they have, like, no.
So it's a way that people can express their feelings that is more fun and exciting?
Yeah, that's what I believe. I see more... real, more emotions that we need than we would get from normal everyday objects that we see today in drama.
So you're saying that spook houses bring out kind of repressed emotions in people? It gives them a place to express themselves?
Yeah, it's not for people that want to just scare people. And that's actually the big appeal to it to a lot of the younger kids. But after doing it for a year, they see the art in it, and then they see how others express themselves. Picture like the mousy shy girl, and once you get her into the makeup and she wears the costume, she's the loudest person there. People who are sluggish most of the time are like the quickest people.
So they're able to express another side of themselves.
Yeah, uh-huh. That expression that most of the time people tell them to slow down, that's not very ladylike or gentlemanlike, or it's time to be quiet.
Mm-hmm.
All that repression just... bundles up, and sooner or later you just want to scream your lungs out.
And the haunted place house is where you can do that.
Yeah, it's, to me, it's very therapeutic.
Uh-huh.
There we go.
Uh-huh. It's very therapeutic.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Even though it's fear is the trigger, you're saying that it involves a lot of really good feelings, too.
Fear is the one thing that we have a lot these days. I believe that if we work more with our fears instead of trying to hide from them, everyone would be much more open, be a lot happier, and be less stressed.
So do you think that people in spook houses actually do get scared?
Yes.
Adults go in to get scared, right?
Yeah, adults go in to get scared. They're basically just going back through their childhood fears. So they're reliving being a child again.
Interesting.
I mean, like being scared of a clown at the age of 12, being scared of spiders, something jumping out at you. And I'm a roaming scare person. I mean, like haunted houses I work 3 different ways. I scare people, but I am also first aid. I am also a bouncer at the same time.
Explain what is a bouncer?
The bouncer makes sure everyone is safe. Most haunted houses have these little back doors, holes and things, and peepholes for us to look through.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't interfere with their areas, but also we walk around and we ask them, are you okay? Do you need me to get you something sugary, something salty, get you something to drink? 'Cause
so you help the people that are the haunters?
Yes.
To give them support?
Yes, and if they need a bathroom break, I stay there mm-hmm. while they go to the bathroom, then they come back.
When you're in a spook house, there's people in the spook house who are watching to make sure that nothing dangerous happens?
Yes, because you're in a tight space, and then you don't know how some of these people react if you're still new to it or you haven't been paying that much attention.
So the danger is mostly to the people who are working there?
Yes.
Because people will attack them?
Yes. There are those that need liquid courage. And those that get drunk before they go in because they're like, oh, I'm too scared of this already. And those are the same people that go to clubs that has to drink to be able to dance and have fun with people. We have to worry about being punched. We have to worry about being thrown against a wall. Haunters are actually more in danger than the people who pay to be there.
What other kind of things have you done since you did Chucky when you were 5 years old?
One of my favorite is I like to be a witch doctor. I actually have a skull. I drilled a couple holes and gave him hair, gave him a couple crystals in his head. He holds candy. I go towards kids that are younger than the age of 10 and people that are more scared of me than I can be scared of them. And basically, I just give them candy saying, I'm glad you're here to be able to express yourself. You're facing fears while also getting that adrenaline running because adrenaline.
So you just being a witch doctor makes them a little bit scared, but you're nice to them.
Yeah, something about me wearing pigtails and a top hat scares people really mm-hmm. well, and I don't know why. More adults are scared of me.
Oh, really?
Than kids. I became more of a low scare. I don't do the gory makeup. I do have a little bit of droplets of blood on me, but
and so you're kind cool. of why don't you want to be more gory and
at a haunted house you need to balance mm-hmm. everything. You need to have at least 40% gory and then 40% non-gory, then you need those in the middle that are just you don't look dangerous but I'm scared of you still.
That's you.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, you are able to kind of judge how much to scare somebody. You're able to kind of scope people out.
Yeah. I believe that any haunted house should always have good props, good people, but also good training. And after a while, you get this sense of what's a good scare and what's a bad scare.
The first time you did this, you were 5 years old.
Yes.
And then did you do it again really soon after that? Have you been doing this your whole life?
I would do it every year of my life. Yes.
Would you miss this if you couldn't do it?
Yes, I would.
What would you miss?
I'd miss being able to put together a costume, put my makeup on the way I like to, with all the screams and stuff like that.
You enjoy seeing people scream. And
yeah.
So are you scared of something?
What would I? Am I anymore? I think it means like I should be.
Well, what gives you an adrenaline rush?
Scaring other people, really.
So you've moved beyond getting scared to scaring.
Yeah, I mean, one of my favorite things to do is I'll go to haunted houses and I'll rate how well they do, and. I mean, the only time I've ever had to give a golden prize in the last 10 years was at this one haunted house. And it was hilarious because basically it was me meeting myself as a child.
Oh.
Because mm-hmm. somebody dressed up their 5-year-old as a Chucky doll and had him standing in the corner and they walked up to me and it scared me so bad.
That's awesome. Like people when go to spook houses, they experience adrenaline, right?
For me, it's not the same. I don't feel adrenaline when I'm scaring people.
When people are being scared, they're
yes.
feeling adrenaline, right?
Yeah, they feel the adrenaline. And
so you think they come for the adrenaline rush?
Yeah, the adrenaline rush because all year long they're always repressing themselves until they get there because you can't. You don't want to sit there screaming your head off over a turkey or when Santa comes. I mean, most kids at the younger age, they'll start screaming for Santa at that age. But once you get older, you have to say to yourself, what can I do to get rid of this energy? Because a lot of people don't have a lot of hobbies that raises their adrenaline. And you should at least raise your adrenaline once a week.
Because it makes you feel alive.
Yeah, it helps your heart. It helps with your red and white blood cells. It actually helps with your weight control and your eating habits. It It actually makes you a lot healthier if you can get scared for like 5 minutes a week.
Okay, well, speaking of being scared 5 minutes a week, I know that you have a really good scream.
Uh-oh, yeah.
Would you give us a scream?
Yeah. To stand up for it, though, I can't do.
Okay, she's standing up.
I can't do scream sitting up.
This is Anna doing her craft.
Let's see if I can do this. Might have to take a couple tries.
It's also proof that our sound room is pretty good because nobody looked up.
I'm glad.
I definitely heard it. Thank you so much. Is there anything else that you think is important?
We need Halloween.
Why do we need Halloween?
We're getting to this point where Halloween is getting shorter and shorter. Like, you go to the stores and it's not even Halloween yet. It hasn't even passed and they're already at 50%, 70% off. They're making room for Christmas. And I've been talking to a lot of people from other states, and Halloween stuff only stays on the shelf for a week before they take it out and they throw the rest of it away. It's not a devil's holiday like everyone thinks it is. It's for kids to express themselves with, I want to be a princess. It's the one day where a lot of kids can be what they want to be imagination-wise.
Adrenaline.
It's the dressing up. It's the adrenaline. It's being neighborly and actually being there to give candy to trick-or-treaters or build your own little haunted walk in your backyard. I mean, you'd be surprised how entertaining it is and sometimes stressful for a lot of people that they take so much work into doing this. I mean, like, it's more of a community because Christmas is closer to being with family and stuff like that. So is Thanksgiving. We need holidays where we are with other people.
And it's more of a public holiday.
Yeah, Halloween to me is a public holiday.
Thank you so much, Anna.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. And happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween.
And if you've just joined us, this is Local Talk, and I'm your host for today, Ursula Rudenberg. That was Anna Samt, who is an Ames resident who has worked in haunted houses most of her life. Full disclosure, I'm one of those people who doesn't ever go on roller coasters, never goes to scary movies, and I've certainly never been to a haunted house. But I do run a radio station, which manages to scare me half to death on a regular basis, which seems to satisfy my need for fear and adrenaline. So I found Anna's description really interesting. And after hearing a story, I became really interested in a release that KHOI received last week from Bambi Yost, ISU Assistant Professor of Landscape Architecture, and Heather Sauer, Communication Specialist from ISU Design Administration, in which Bambi Yost describes herself as one of an increasing number of researchers who say that we should understand the need for risk in play environments. Yost is a co-author of Making Room for Risk in Play Environments and Playground Standards, an article which was published in the journal Landscape Research Record No. 5. In September, Yost presented the research at the 20th Triennial International Play Association Conference in Calgary, Canada. Bambi agreed to come in to KHOI yesterday to explain what she meant by this article and just her general theories about play and risk for children.
This is an article that was published in the Landscape Research Record. And so it's a literature review that addresses play equipment standards through the history of the United States and how we've gone to a more and more static type of play that's safer with less injury and less risk. There has been a rise in a need for increasing opportunity for risk-taking and for kids to have more fun on play equipment in particular. Europe and Canada both have organizations that fight for the right to play. Researchers are at the core of them, and then there are some play advocates. So, like, I'm a play advocate.
How did you become a play advocate?
I started out in graduate school at the University of Colorado Denver as a student who was a project manager working with a professor who was a landscape architect. We rebuilt 21 schoolyards. And so at that time, we weren't even allowed to put a rock or a boulder on any school ground because they were worried that it would actually be a risk and a hindrance. We were meeting with all the community members, teachers, you know, phys ed teachers, et cetera. And everyone was so afraid of trying something new. I even had phys ed instructors who were afraid of putting grass out there. The biggest issue is about lawsuits. The fear is that if you don't have a pre-approved piece of play equipment that's been tested, run through the ringer in terms of safety standards, and we have many different ways of evaluating the play equipment in the United States. We are actually the leading source of information globally in terms of how you can go about creating safe play equipment for kids and safe fall zones and safe safety surfaces and things like that. So what's happened is we've made really, really safe play areas, right, over time. But we've also removed some of the opportunities to experiment with some other things that are not considered play equipment. So a rock, a big giant boulder, is not play equipment. You can't standardize it. You know, it's a natural form. It comes in various sizes. It's not the same kind of control.
Are you aware of how this concern about safety started?
1908. There was one case in particular that started off with the first lawsuit. So in 1908, they start talking about liability, you know, so it's product liability. In 1972 was one of the major turning points. That's when they started doing the CPSC's Handbook for Public Playground Safety. It's this creation of consumer product safety standards, right? Tree limbs, you know, and tree stumps and all the things we think about in a natural or a naturalized environment aren't considered manufactured play equipment, right?
So they can't be standardized.
So they're not standardized. So you have to have everything set with a standard and a certificate in order for it to be manufactured for all of us. And there is an economic element. What happens is there is money to be had and made by maintaining play equipment standards because the play equipment manufacturers now have all set up for the play equipment standards. If we encourage natural play with logs and branches, that's not something you manufacture. They lose money. Mm-hmm. So you have manufacturers actually fighting for the right to control certified play equipment. And then you also have, you know, people who have businesses now that have been set up for years, like the consumer safety product guides, that they want to maintain that control too. Mm-hmm. So it's an interesting dynamic. And this is why natural play has been such a difficult thing to get approved. And then there's also a legal element because it's really hard to say whose fault something is when it's not standardized and you don't know exactly how it gets installed or placed.
Mm-hmm. So where do you think things are at with kids today?
Today, they have a set limit on play equipment. And I think the big concern right now is that we've had so many safety limits placed on us, everything from not being able to let your kid walk to school to, you know, not letting your kid out of sight ever. There are some general fears that are cultural. Unfortunately, they're reinforced through the media oftentimes, right? So like fear of mystery, fear of not knowing something. Those are fears for parents and now for kids. I think what's happened is they're seeing fewer and fewer youth actually going outside and physically participating in any way, shape, or form. Like they're not walking as much. They're not exercising as much. They're not utilizing play areas as much. Kids not having the same kind of physical motor skills, and they're not actually able to advance in some ways in terms of social and emotional controls, for example. There's been evidence that kids who are not taking risks at an early age don't process fear and they don't process challenge the same way when they age. And so when they get older, the moment that they have an experience that's fearful for them, and it might even be taking a test, they can shut down and they have many more emotional problems and coping skills are not as strong because they didn't do certain things at a younger age. And so that's coming out of psychology. So there are all kinds of researchers looking at different factors. And psychologists have found that kids that are actively challenging themselves, that have a sense of autonomy or freedom to play on their own without adult supervision, you know, hovering over them, are more likely to actually be able to process all kinds of emotions later in life better. And so if we don't encourage ourselves and our children to take risks, whether that's just like walking up and ordering a soda at the counter, because for some kids that's really scary. If they don't do those things when they're young, they have a much higher chance of failing at something that's even greater or more significant later in life. Like, say they go for a job interview and they're finding right now that like kids today that they're going out for a job interview, some of their parents are going with them because they're so terrified of the job interview and their parents are so terrified they're not going to get that job. There is a culture at the moment of hyperprotection, and I think the swing back right now is that we're coming out of this bubble wrap age because there was a book written about the bubble wrap society where there literally are families that were going into hotel rooms and bubble wrapping all the furniture so their kids wouldn't hit their heads while they were in a hotel room, for example.
Really?
Yeah, really.
That's not an urban myth?
It's not an urban myth, no. I met the psychologist who actually interviewed these families that were doing it.
So this movement that you're describing that kind of advocates for less safe play, what is the premise?
It's not necessarily less safe play. It's risky play. There's a difference between something being safe and unsafe or risky. The benefits of risk-taking and risky play, there are multiple types of benefits. Physical activity is one of the biggest. Balance is a huge component, and especially over the long haul of our lives. If you don't learn how to balance at an early age, you will probably never master it. When you're older, in particular when you're elderly, you're really going to struggle because you never had the balance skills to begin with, perhaps as a young adult and on. Physical activity levels have been linked to risk and risk-taking. And what that means is that kids that are more prone to risky play and risk-taking are also more prone to having higher levels of physical activity throughout their lives. That leads into more adventurous sports, you know, more adventurous activities as a whole. And then also the emotional component, right? And self-regulation is critical. And they really do learn that.
Self-regulation, that's a term that means basically learning to calm yourself and to deal with stressful situations.
Stressful situations, frustration tolerance, right? Like how do you make sure that you want to work through a project or a problem? Or how do you overcome the challenge of getting to the top of that climbing ladder or structure, you know, and knowing that you can do it, because a lot of kids give up and they quit right away.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you don't have other kids that are pushing themselves or adults who are in some way encouraging you to try something, a lot of times kids won't do things. And if they're limited to doing things in the first place, then they limit themselves over time even more. And that's a really problematic thing in the long run in terms of taking risks when you become an adult and having faith in yourself, you know, just a sense of confidence that you know you can do certain things and also knowing your limits. You know, getting afraid because you're climbing something and you almost fall down and you know that if you had fallen, you would really be hurt, right? That moment is a critical turning point for you because it tells you, okay, this is my limit right now. I shouldn't do that right now. I need to either gain upper body strength or something. And not all kids process like that, but you do know your limit. I mean, you recognize that you almost fell or someone caught you, you know. So doing risk-taking behavior, you're more likely to gain skills. You know your limits. You don't stop yourself as readily before you try something. Those are good skills.
Experiencing fear is an opportunity to practice.
Yeah, fear regulation.
Fear regulation.
How we regulate our fear and how we react to it.
Let's talk about Halloween for a minute.
Oh, yeah.
Give me your thoughts about Halloween.
I love Halloween.
Why do you love Halloween?
I love Halloween because I love the whole make-believe, dress up, you know, hide, pretend who you are, and, you know, scare people if you want to, or scare the trick-or-treaters that come to your house.
Does it connect at all with your ideas about risk-taking?
Totally. I would say that for Halloween, especially if you're a kid like I was, where you could go and walk on your own without your parents, and you would go door-to-door to people's houses, and you don't know them, you know, and so it was like, I don't know who lives down the road, you know, and we'd walk in the dark, because I lived in the middle of nowhere, and then we'd eventually end up at somebody's house and knock on the door, and you didn't know if they actually celebrated Halloween or not. That fear of who's going to answer the door and what are we going to experience was always a fun factor. Walking in the dark alone at night was always a fun factor. And then just being dressed up and trying to scare each other all night. And the fun of that is that it's an adrenaline rush, right? But it's also your endorphins are going, right? So it's a double whammy and it gives you a heightened sense of awareness.
Is this why people also go on roller coasters?
Yeah. And researchers have found, like, as you've gotten a higher level of adrenaline rush going on in your system, you're actually more likely to be attracted to someone or to something or have a stronger memory associated with it. But the fright houses, things like that, they tend to be really, really fun for kids because they know they're going to get scared before they go in. So they're prepared for it mentally. Mm-hmm. And that for them is a good thing because it's self-regulation of fear. And it's overcoming fear, and it's overcoming this sense of risk and this sense of unknown, so that they're more willing to do it again in the future. And mm-hmm. Halloween is great for that.
And this is Local Talk. I'm your host for today, Ursula Rudenberg. Thanks for listening in on my Halloween show. Daniel Bagley is here from Nevada. He is a member of the Des Moines Two Rivers Story Spinners and the Northland Storytelling Network. Welcome, Dan.
Well, thank you so much for having me. And it's that time of year, isn't it, where spooky tales can happen.
They can happen.
Yes, indeed. I thought I'd tell you the McAllister story about a boy who decides to run away from home. Now, he's about 8 years old, and he's never run away from home before. So he's practicing in his own mind of where he would go, because they've moved to the new neighborhood. He's not real familiar with the neighborhood. And wouldn't you know it, as a runaway, he's got to get a sandwich, pack a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, and throw a Skittle in his bag. And then he took off. He ran. Well, he went down to the street just a little way, and he started going into the woods. Now, as we all know, when you go into the woods, you can only go halfway. Then you start coming out of the woods.
Oh.
But about halfway, he saw this old building. It was not quite a mansion, but it was run down. It looked like at one time, perhaps, it indeed had been a mansion. And as he got closer and closer, he could see that the windows were all broken out of it. And the place was kind of overgrown with weeds, and there was a walkway. So he opened the gate to the walkway, and as he pressed against it, it went and opened. And he went down the walkway, and he followed it, and it came to an old family cemetery. And in the cemetery, there were two tombstones. And one said, Jim McMasters. And it had his birth date and the day he died. But the other stone had nothing on it, as if it was waiting for somebody else to die and be buried there. So he could feel the goosebumps getting on his back, and he walked back down to the beginning of the trail and started heading towards the house. And as he walked towards the house, he could see old bats starting to take off, and he knew that nobody had been in this house for many years, or so he thought. As he went up to the front stairs, he stepped on the first stair, and it seemed kind of weak and spongy, but it held him. He went to the second stair, and it worked. Third step, it worked. He started cross on the porch, and it was real creaky. And he went up to the front door, and he was going to knock like somebody would answer in a haunted house, but he knew that he should try. So he knocked. Nothing happened. And he thought, well, surely there's nobody here. So he started to push the door open. It was stuck. And he pushed it harder. And it opened. And he looked inside. And to the right was an old room. And to the left was a room. And straight ahead was the main room. And it had a fireplace. And it hadn't been used for many, many years. It was dark and dreary. And there was holes in the roof so rain would come dripping in. And he thought, I'm kind of hungry, and I know I've got that peanut butter and jelly sandwich. So he looked around, and there was this old couch. And he was concerned perhaps about rats. Mm. And he wouldn't want a rat to get him. Mm. So he got close, and he took an old sheet and threw it across the couch and sat down and started to eat that sandwich, and it was really good, because the first time runaway has to have something to eat. And about that time, he heard some scratching, and there was a rat scurried across the floor, and he got really nervous, and he was gulping that sandwich, and then he could feel something, but he couldn't see it yet, but he could feel a presence of something evil. And he looked, and there was a pair of hands. Just hands, no body, no head, just hands coming at him. And they got close, and they opened, and there in the middle of a hand was a gold ring with a red ruby on it. Wow. And he thought, what is that? And about that time, the hand touched him, and he jumped and was startled, and he fell over backwards on that couch, and the floor behind him was all rotted out. And he fell through, and he landed on a pile of sacks in the basement. And he thought, oh, I've got to get out of here. Oh. And so he decided to, wait, there was a set of stairs, and he ran up the stairs, but his foot fell through one, and he got further up the stairs, and wouldn't you know it, the door was locked and bolted, and he was stuck in the basement. He went back down, and he started, oh, what am I going to do? And about that time, water started to trickle through the foundation in the basement where he was. And pretty soon big hole opened, and water poured in. The other side poured in, and suddenly he was up to his waist, and he couldn't swim. He knew he was in trouble, but maybe, just maybe, he could float up and hang on as best he could to get to that hole and crawl out. But it was not to be. As he got closer and closer, his head was against the bottom of the floor above, and water started to close over his face. And he started to breathe and scream, and the water covered him over. And he went under the water, and as he was down in the water, he could see all kinds of things floating through the dark, stinky water. And then he saw a body, a woman dressed in white. And she was floating through, and her hair was flowing in the water, and her hands were gray. And about that time, he went to sleep. He passed out. And he woke up. He felt himself on the ground, and now the ground was dry, and he was dry. And he could hear some banging on the door. Hello, are you in there? And he's like, yeah, help. And it was the local police. They'd been looking for him because he was a runaway. And the police found him. He said, "You can't believe what I saw." And the police said, "Well, what we saw is you missing, and your folks are really mad, and you better come home with me now, but we have to go to the police station, and I know a shortcut." Well, Billy was telling them all about this adventure, and the cop was kind of like, "Yeah, okay." They got to the police station, and he met his parents, and Billy says, "Please, Mr. Policeman, you have got to talk. Check, do anything you can to find out about this." Well, the parents reunited, and Billy was told about not skipping school. But the policeman, he checked the records, and indeed, Mr. McMaster's wife vanished about 10 years prior to that. So as they were going there, he called, they went around a curve, and as the cop was told, there was a sign floating amongst the body, "Dangerous curve, slow down." And they went by this sign, "Dangerous curve, slow down." And it was as if the spirit spoke to him. And they got some divers, and they went into that water, and lo and behold, they found an old car with the body of Mrs. McMaster's, the new wife, in her wedding dress, in the car. And she had been gone many years. Well, at the funeral, the only people that came was the police officer, Billy and his parents, and they had the burial, and there on a stone had Mrs. McMaster's date of birth and the day she died. And Billy went to school from then on, but he never told anybody about what he found in his pocket at the cemetery. It was a gold ring with a red ruby. And that's the story of the castle.
True story?
One never knows.
Thank you, Dan Bagley from Nevada. Dan, thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome. It was fun.
It's great to have you. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I moved to Nevada in about 1989 from Wyoming. And I went to high school in Boys Town, Nebraska, graduated in 1968, went to college in New Hampshire, and moved to the Midwest because I wanted a job with the railroad. That's why I have the name Choo-Choo Man Dan as my
email. Man Dan.
I met a lady here, married my wife Kathy, who's been a great help in storytelling and makeup, as you may have seen some of my pictures. But that's pretty much it.
And you're a professional storyteller,
yes.
Is that right?
Yep.
And who is the Des Moines River Two Rivers Story Spinners?
The Two Rivers Story Spinners were a group of people who loved to tell stories. And we joined that guild, and we learn about storytelling, the craft of telling stories, how to make a story. All stories have a beginning, a middle, and an end. And without one of those components, it's not a very good story.
Uh-huh.
So what'll happen, we create stories, and then we tell the story, and our fellow storytellers critique them for us. And Mike King here from Ames is the president of that organization down there, and he's a great storyteller as well. But Maureen Courty, who spoke here before, and a number of us all have learned a great deal about storytelling down there.
And the Northland Storytelling Network, that's a network of storytellers in the Midwest?
Yes. I belong to a guild. All storytellers ought to belong to a guild, and ours is the Two River Story Spinners. The guilds belong to their regional group, which is, for us is Northland Storytelling Network, and all the networks belong to the National Storytelling Network. So we all have story contacts all over the country.
And where do you typically tell stories?
Wherever two or more are gathered.
You grew up in Boys Town, is that
yes.
correct? How is Halloween celebrated in Boys Town? What happens there?
Well, to be honest, nobody gets really dressed up and stuff, but they do a lot of pranks, lots of pranks, and they'll have candy and stuff like that. But generally, Boys Town at that time, now this is 50 years ago, we had 20 kids to a cottage, and you'd dress the cottage up a little bit, and you'd have a bag or a bucket of candy, and kids from other cottages would come to your door and you'd give them some candy and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. So Boys Town is something that we all grew up hearing about.
Yes, yes.
Can you describe a little bit what it's like to actually live there?
Sure. Father Flanagan's Boys Town is its own world. It is a town. Many people don't know that. It's its own town. We have a mayor and all that kind of thing. And when I first went there, I'm originally from Boston.
Where is Boys Town?
It's in Boys Town is Boys Town, Nebraska.
Boys Town, Nebraska. Okay.
Yeah, 68010.
Okay.
And Omaha has expanded around it tremendously. Uh-huh. But at the time, Boys Town was out in the middle of cornfields. Uh-huh. And it was totally alien to me because I had never seen anything like that. What's that green stuff called corn? Miles and miles of corn and something called beans, and I didn't know anything about that. But when I got to Boys Town, I found out very quickly they have order, which I needed in my life desperately. And they have consequence, and good things get you good things, and bad things get you bad consequences. So it's a learning experience. I went to school all 4 years there, wound up working on a dairy, had my own little small herd, and graduated in 1968.
Mm-hmm. And about how many boys actually are there?
At that time, it was 1,000.
1,000.
Yeah, now they're – I don't know what the numbers are now because the concept is philosophically entirely different, and I dare say better.
Better.
They have a family living of environment as opposed to 20 boys in a cottage.
Mm-hmm.
And the now they have a house mother and father with their own kids and perhaps as many as 10 kids. I'm not real sure, but it's completely different than it was in my day.
Mm-hmm. So, Dan, do you like Halloween?
I love Halloween.
Why do you love Halloween?
Well, because it's fun to watch the little kids come up to the door. Now, I'm a grandparent now. My kids are out in Colorado and one in Des Moines. But when the little kids come all dressed up and excited, it's really fun, and that excitement is contagious.
Uh-huh.
And last night we played bingo down in Des Moines with a group of kids from the Ames Choral Society. I'd never done that before, but it was a riot. The kids had fun, and I've never played bingo with little pictures and stuff. And the reward is to go get 3 pieces of candy, and I bet you every kid won bingo at least 4 or 5 times. But it was just
really
great.
Cute.
Bingo's a good time.
That's really cute.
Yeah, the kids and bingo and Halloween's great. And they were all dressed up. It was fun.
Okay, so I guess we got to close the show. I'll give you the last word, but let me first say that you've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and I've been your host, Ursula Rudenberg. Thank you for listening. Earlier in the show, we heard from Annis Amt and Bambi Yost. Local Talk airs at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. here on KHOI. Also, remember that you can hear it online at khoifm.org, on demand, where you'll find links to guests and information you've heard during the program, or streaming live at khoifm.org. Our theme song, as always, is Backtrackin' by Tom Richards and Al Harris, from their CD, The Ballad of Kay Shelley. And we also heard Spiderwebs in My Hair by Clark Ford, our own Ames musician. Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a show, so if you'd like to try your hand at reporting, come and join us. We will train you. Stay tuned for Headline News and Democracy Now! At 8 a.m. with National News and Morning Masterpieces at 9 a.m. And remember that you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening. We'll see you again on the radio. And Dan, what is your final word as we leave on this Halloween show?
Watch out tonight in the streets for the ghosts and goblins. Go slow.
Shadows are Support for KHOI comes from Stevens Auditorium, presenting Rebirth Brass Band from the French Quarter of New Orleans to Ames, Iowa, on Thursday, November 2nd at 7:30 p.m. More information can be found at center.iastate.edu.
KHOI is funded in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. Find job opportunities throughout Ames and Story County at workinames.com. Again, that's workinames.com.